Hello and welcome to Null Signal Station, the official podcast of Null Signal Games. For all your news, views and goings on from around the Netrunner community, my name's Ed, he, him, and thanks ever so much for joining us on a slightly extended break post-World Championships. Obviously, it took quite a lot of effort for us to get that episode out. I do hope you all enjoyed it. And I'm joined this evening by a special guest host. You may know him. He is the Cephalopod Wizard himself. Hello.
Hello. It is me, Cephalopod Wizard. He, him. I'm taking over more of the podcast. First the rules, then the intro, then the world.
When you've taken over the podcast, what do you think your next step for taking over the world would be? Obviously, that's quite a big jump between rules and full podcast.
Print more squid cards. That's my agenda.
How many squid cards would make a squid cycle?
I think one or two sets ought to do it.
Okay. Do you envisage the full rotation of FFG and NSG cards at the point when the squid cycle comes out?
No, I'm sure people will make the right choices themselves.
You attended a CO recently or upcoming, didn't you?
Yes, I've attended a couple of COs locally, and we have a lot of COs. Do we want to jump into the news?
I think that's a great idea. So the big news, obviously, post-World Championships, is that there's been a huge amount of tournaments, and there are even more tournaments coming up. So I think what we're going to do is I'll run over the last few weeks or so's main results, the big results from the community. And then I'm going to hand over to Seth for a little rundown of what's to come as everyone tries to squeeze in their COs before the end of the year. So the biggest event over the last few weeks was the UK Nationals with an incredible 90 players there. Massive congratulations to my good friend Rotom Appliance, who took the tournament down on Sable and, of course, PD, as is his brand. Another huge Nationals, I believe, was held online. The Singapore Nationals, which we saw a fantastic 30 players at. Massive congratulations there to Ying64, taking down what was an absolutely stacked field. And of course, the Italian Nationals happened just last weekend as we were recording. And it was an outside winner. It was Augustus Caesar, I believe, from Ireland, came across and took down Italian Nationals. So massive congratulations there. Of course, outside of in-person tournaments, we've had a couple of AMTs since we last spoke on the news. Two, in fact. So October's big field there and taken down by Bahram Wu. And then November's, you've heard the name once already, for a second win in these big five, Augustus Caesar took down November's AMT. Fantastic. There's an AMT coming up in December, isn't there?
That's right. There's an AMT coming up on the 17th of December. That'll be online. You can check Always Be Running to check what time that's going to be happening at. Everyone is welcome to participate. No entry fee required.
Yeah, these events have been really popular. And I know AMTs are probably taking a break in January, just with the Circuit Breaker tournament, obviously, through January. But I heard rumours that there's some exciting news coming up about February AMTs. I think we're going to see a packed schedule, so be sure to check that out ahead of time. Seth, what else is on the horizon?
So we have circuit openers happening in a lot of cities, and I'm going to list off the cities that they're in. Sorry, I can't read off all the cool titles. We have finite time. In the United States, we have circuit openers coming up in Seattle, Berkeley, Reynoldsburg, and Charlotte, and Pittsburgh. In Canada, we have COs coming up in Victoria, Montreal, and Calgary. In the UK, COs are coming up in Warwick and Nottingham. In Belgium, a CO is occurring in Leuven. In Spain, there's a CO in Barcelona. In Germany, we have COs in Frankfurt and Augsburg. In Italy, quite a ways in the future, there's a CO scheduled in Milano. And there's a CO coming up in Australia, in Brisbane. Also, independent of these COs, we have the return of the Ocarina online tournament.
This what, is what short is Ocarina? For what is Ocarina?
Ocarina is short for One Kind of Runner in New Angeles, from the flavor text on the beloved Caddy Jones, long rotated. And this is a special format where instead of picking an identity, you pick a unique connection or an agenda, and you get the text on those cards as an identity. There's a spreadsheet of deck sizes and influence for the specific identities, and this will be run on December 9th. This is Ocarina 5.
Ocarina 5, December the 9th. That could be in just a couple of days by the time this episode comes out. So make sure, check that out if you're looking for something to do next weekend online. I've played an Ocarina tournament myself. It's a bundle of laughs. There's absolutely busted decks in there waiting to be found. So if you're a deck builder, if you enjoy a bit of jank, it's the tournament for you.
It's a good chance to brew. Haven't we always wondered what would happen if we could have DAG online from turn one? Unfortunately, DAG's not a connection.
No, I was going to say, not a connection. Cats aren't connections, are they? Are they? Is there a cat connection? Let's hand over to the rules expert, Seth. Seth, is there a cat connection card? No. I was going to ask you something. Oh, yeah, outside of tournaments, has there been any news from Null Signal Games in the past month?
I got announced first president. Engagement.
Oh, yes. Hello. We probably don't need to edit that out. We have a new president of engagement, and I believe that is you, Ed?
That's right. Yes, I've taken over as vice president of engagement for Null Signal Games. I was joined as well with another new vice president, Pai AM, has taken over the role of vice president, Department of People. So they're going to have a look at EDI, and they're going to be looking after recruitment, and there's some other things in store as well. I'm hoping to get him on an episode in the very near future, hopefully this side of Christmas, so be sure to check that out.
You can't just ask me, have we made any news in the past month? We make so much news.
We do news all the time. We've done PAX U as well, haven't we? PAX Unplugged.
That's right. As we record this, people are manning a booth in PAX Unplugged somewhere, trying to find more future Netrunners.
And one of those, I believe, is a very famous game designer's child who is super into Netrunner and turned up at their booth on the first day, I believe. So I won't name the game designer, but just say if you're looking for company from John, then it could be him. Seth, should we go to our next segment?
That's right. We have, I believe the next segment is an interview with Sokka, the winner of the World's Netrunner Tournament.
I wonder if Sokka's got any valuable insights on the world of Netrunner, having won back-to-back World Championships. Should we find out?
Who's we? I'm out.
Sanjay.
Yes, hello Ed, how's it going?
I'm doing really well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, you know, some fear of missing out in past tense from Worlds. It sounds like it was a really nice time.
It was fantastic. I hope you've been enjoying hearing what I got up to.
I love hearing what you get up to.
What have you been up to?
School stuff. I'm a teacher. I teach. I've been doing some drawings of ghosts that could be in A Christmas Carol. So instead of the ghosts of Christmas Past, you got like the ghost of Loud and Angry Chastisement, the ghost of Winter Solstice, that kind of thing. You know, normal stuff.
Fantastic. I take it the Muppets Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah, there's a ghost of Christmas Carol adaptations as well. This is a great interview with me, isn't it?
Yeah. Should we get someone else on?
Yeah.
Who would you like to hear from at Worlds that we haven't heard from yet?
I would like to hear from Saka234, whose pronouns are he, him, and the two-time world champion. I would love to hear from William.
Should we do that?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Who are you?
I'm Saka. Also, real name is William. Yeah, I'm the now two-time world champion, which is crazy to say out loud.
How's it feel? Like, obviously, that's a difficult question to ask. So let me ask a different question. How's it feel saying that you're the two-time world champion in that runner?
Honest, I think that's the first time I've actually said that out loud.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to sink in, but it.
Have you had to kind of explain your achievement to maybe people outside of the game?
I don't know if like explain my achievement, but there's a lot of people who kind of like followed me on social media, and they knew like that I was going to this tournament. Yeah, I got a lot of like congratulations, and people who don't know much or anything about the game, who seem to appreciate that it is a big deal. But I honestly, like, I in my mind, I have trouble like kind of understanding how big of a deal that is. Yeah, I'm in law school right now in my second year, and it's interesting because so today, as we film this, is the call day for summer job interviews, and it's like there's this like very big process. It feels like this is the world, and everything matters a lot. And yeah, I'm coming off a day of a bit of like very big disappointment. That there's this like firm that I really wanted. I didn't get a call from them. But like, I'm still like running into people as the day goes on who are like, hey, like, you know, I saw you on social media that like you did this and like, great job. Like, I'm kind of saying like, you know, thank you as I'm being super sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. but yeah, there's
ups and downs, right? Ups and downs.
Yeah,
well, yeah. I will say, you know, if that firm is listening, which I'm sure they are, you all don't understand like what it is to be a two-time world champion in this tournament, like, or in this format. In that, like, it's so implausible to win once, even as skilled as you are, and doing it twice is just so absolutely incredible. And you know, they don't understand the extent to which you're playing above the rim, like in a field of incredible players, like putting on clinics. I mean, like, obviously there's other players that are very, very good as well, but goodness, you are very good at Netrunner.
Thank you. Yeah, it's, I mean, I'll reiterate that point about like it is like highly unlikely. And yeah, I mean, you need a degree of like understanding of the game, of prep, of skill, yes, but also you need a large amount of luck as well. Like you can be the best player in the room, very prepared, but like luck needs to be on your side. And the fact that it was like 2 years in a row is still sinking in, and it will continue to sink in for a while, I imagine.
Yeah, and probably you can't explain to people at, you know, that don't know Netrunner, like what a big deal it is to take Waylon to a world championship win for the first time since the very first world championship. Also, I wasn't able to look up the stats, but I don't know how many times a deck, an ID has won worlds with only four people playing that ID in the whole tournament. And I don't want to get too into this because I will say, like, you've done a really nice job with like your like talking about your IDs and like your deck choices, like on your channel. So I don't want to like get too into that. But what went into your choices?
Why BTL? Why BTL?
I'll start by saying that it is kind of crazy. Hey, I never thought about this, but there were four players playing BTL in 260. And I remember during the tournament, there were, I don't remember the name, but the one of the other players who were playing BTL were like, they came up to me and they're like, hey, like, you know, I saw you're playing BTL. Like, I'm one of those other players. Like, can't wait to, like, you know, check out what it is that you're doing. That'd be an interesting stat to find out is like, what is the lowest represented ID that ended up winning worlds in each of and like compiling that.
Yeah, I know in the past I've really wanted to be the top of whatever my ID was, and I can't believe how tough that would have been to like bring BTL, like I'm gonna be the best BTL, and then here's Sokka.
So the corp deck kind of came up. I wanted to find a corp that was unknown, that is good into a field of runners that are designed to beat kind of the most common corp threats. So you're kind of playing, you're trying to stay ahead of the game in that sense. And we kind of knew, like I kind of expected that the top corp decks to beat of the known corp decks was Rush Ob, PD, Asa, and different flavors of NBN. So there was like R plus tags, that there was a lot of people playing that, like a tempo score tag plan. And then there was NEH, and there's NEH like asset tempo with like Amani Sinai, and there's also the NEH Reaper function kill. Those are like the main corp decks, and runners are trying to be fast enough and install their breakers fast enough to deal with the rush that is PD and Ob. That's probably like the biggest threat that you like needed to design your runner deck to do. And in combination with the fact that Botulus is at an all-time low in terms of the time that Botulus has been legal, I kind of like took advantage of that by bringing this BTL. Was if you play like this Glacier deck that makes servers cost a lot of money, and you're taking advantage of the fact that there's no Botulus, that people aren't really playing Botulus, and it could potentially do really well. The other thing about corps is that all the corps have a flaw in them. Like, there is no corp, I think, that is just like very good across the field. All the corps have some issue. We saw a lot of Essa show up. Like, Essa is like really good against Ob and PD and Asa. There's just like runners just have a lot of different tools, and they can respond to different corps, and corps have different tools to respond to different runners. And like, that's a sign of a very healthy meta. But if you're somebody who's preparing for a tournament and you want to win all your games, it's a very, very difficult task to try to prepare and build a deck that you're comfortable with. So yeah, tried a lot of PE. I think if PE is good, it could be very good, just because, as I said, like, there's a lot of different corps that are pulling runners in different directions, and some kind of like net damage deck is probably something that runners are not expected to play against and prepared for. But ultimately, I couldn't make that work. So looked at Wayland Glacier. It's the best way to play Glacier right now. Is out of Built to Last, I feel, because Built to Last is like built-in economy. You can spend a click to advance and gain two, which ends up coming down to essentially you're clicking for a credit, and you place in the first advancement token somewhere. It could be your bio vault, it could be an agenda, it could be a clearinghouse, it could be your piece of ice. It's really, really good with Mest and Chespo, which is the best ice in your deck. And also, everybody's fractor is Cleaver. Cleaver boosts strength very poorly, so you could take advantage of that by playing Theros and Treeline. Things just kind of gelled together to kind of make this Glacier deck that made every server cost more than 10 credits to break. And you put a couple biovolts in there and then it just becomes too much. Mm. So, yeah. And it's very fun. Like to me, like being able to advance your ice to get money is a way of like advancing your board and econ at the same time. Which is a level of click compression that doesn't require an econ card. And that's really important. Like with Build to Last, you can draw poorly and just draw ice and draw no econ, and you can kind of like install your ice, advance your ice, and click for credits, and you're doing fine. Whereas classically, corp decks that are playing slow and have that slow glacier plan need a daily quest, or they need some kind of econ to get them going. And like a Build to Last does still really want their econ, really want the wall to wall, but like you can survive for a chunk of time without it. Whereas Acme Glacier in the past before, for example, if you didn't have your daily quest by turn 3 or 4, like you're doing very, very poorly in that game probably. But Build to Last is a little bit more resilient, so I like that. Yeah, it has a flaw in Botulus, obviously, as I've mentioned, and also it has a flaw to Hush Irisanna. Like every Irisanna is playing Hush, and that's a very, very good runner deck against it. I never beat it in testing. I did actually beat it twice in the tournament, but that matchup's like 10%. For you, but that's just a matchup that you have to expect. That's a matchup that you have to take.
That actually answers a question that I had from watching some of your post-game little shorts that you did.
Yeah.
So if for those of you listening who don't know that Saka put these out, he recorded after every round, more or less, like, hey, everybody, here's what happened in the round. And you had mentioned that your Shaper matchup wasn't so good, and I didn't know why, but that does make sense with the Hush.
The thing is, like, Irisanna is weakest when it's trying to set up, when it's trying to install the Urban Art and it's trying to install the Lily Pad and the Simul Chips. Like, that can get a little clunky if you don't find early econ and get the cards in the right order. But eventually, given enough time, you're going to get that whole system set up and you're going to be able to break ice very efficiently. And Slap Vandal is very good against Treeline until Treeline gets past 6 strength. You also are playing probably Conduit. You're playing Conduit. You're also playing Turbine to boost the strength of your rig. So it's got already a really good kit to deal with it, and also the Hush is kind of like definitely the nail in the coffin, because you can just put the Hush somewhere, bring the Akette down, bring the Treeline down, bring the Pharos down, and it's a lot of resources that the corp is spending, and you can Hush the ice. But not only are you Hushing the ice, you can move the Hush around. So if on this turn you want to run the remote, you can go Hush that, go run the remote, and then next turn you want to go run HQ, you can move your Hush. So against like a good Shaper pilot who is able to kind of get all that together and figure out the best place to run, that's a near impossible match. I did mention that I did beat it twice. Once was in Crown of Servers, where I won on time because we only had like 10 minutes to play the game. That one, that doesn't really count in my mind. It's funny, I was basically agenda flooded. I was agenda flooded and I like rushed out this 5-3 super early because I knew that Irisanna has trouble in the early game. And that's usually a really bad play for you as a Glacier deck, because you're spending 2 turns doing nothing. Because when you rush out 3 points and your game plan is not to score out anytime soon, the only thing that really did for you is remove an agenda from the game. But otherwise, it like actively hurts you in terms of getting to 7. But because time was running out, like I knew that I just needed to get some points, so I scored a 5-3, and I basically like drew 4 more agendas by like turn 4 or 5, and the deck only plays 7 agendas. So there were only 2 agendas left in the deck, and my opponent was like, I'm going to slam this Conduit, and like, here's the Cubone, here's the Pichu Cow, here's the here's the slap vandal. We're going to run R&D five times this turn and gain five credits while doing it. But they whiffed every access after access after access because I just had all the agents in hand. So that was one of the games. And then the second Arisana win, which is the real one, was in Swiss in round two, where my opponent had a very bad draw. They basically drew all their programs, drew all the things that cost them money, didn't draw any economy. And I basically went into the matchup going, if we play the long game, I'm eventually going to lose. Like, even if they have a bad opening hand, eventually they will figure something out. And my deck is super slow. So I knew that what I needed to do was I just like rush a clearinghouse kill and hope for the best. So I mulliganed for an early wall to wall and ice for a remote. And I just neglected centrals and just put three ice in front of a wall to wall, got all that ice advanced, and then put a clearinghouse in there. I think I got a clearinghouse kill on like turn seven or turn eight, with a clearinghouse behind three ice. And so,
yeah,
that was like my only out, and I managed to figure that out in the one time in the tournament where it mattered.
So what I'm hearing, you know, is that you came to the tournament with a pretty impressive, you know, understanding of what the threats were, and not only like what all the decks were, but how those decks are lining up versus your deck. And obviously, you know, you're also pretty good at thinking through things on the fly. And you mentioned that this was sort of a team approach. Do you want to do any shout outs and talk about sort of like who supported you getting here?
Yeah. So, I mean, the deck came out when I was basically like looking for a Glacier deck, and I knew that Peter H., I knew that Peter H. had played a lot of Wayland Glacier, and I basically messaged him, who is part of Team Unbanned. And Unbanned is my testing team that I do a lot of testing with. And I was like, hey, like, I know you play a lot of Wayland Glacier. What do you think the archetype is like right now? What's the best that we can kind of work with? And I worked a lot with him to kind of get this deck going, and I really liked it. Again, like, it has issues. You lose the Arisana matchup most of the time, and you, or at least you should. And a lot of our players, this is why I was the only one who ended up playing the deck, is because people like Bridgman didn't want to play a deck that has an obvious bad matchup. And I was more okay with that. I tested the deck a lot on JNet, and also internally with members of Unbanned. And that was very useful. It helped me iron out a lot of the matchups. Specifically, Peter H. helped with most of the deck building. And then I tested a lot of the Arisana matchups with Koga, who destroyed me every time, which is how I kind of came to this conclusion. That was kind of the testing process. I kind of understood theoretically that it would be really good against Krim. And against Anarch, it's kind of hit and miss. Depends what kind of tools they have and if they know the best way to use it. And if I draw my Sadaka to trash the twinning or not.
You mentioned Bridgman. Would you like to talk to us about round one of the World Championship of Netrunner 2023?
Yeah. Oh man. So, and you can see my part of my reaction to this on my YouTube channel. As Sanjay mentioned, I did YouTube shorts in between every round. And before round one, so actually just in general, Bridgman and I think Leopold said this, at the house on one of the days. And he was like me and Bridgman are like the aces of the group, right? We're kind of like, we're like the two guys that are like, okay, we're gonna you know, we're super competitive, we're testing them all the time, and we're going to come show up and make the world's cut. And before the tournament, I was just like walking down the hallway with Bridgman. And by the way, like really, really great guy, really good friend of mine, just in general. And we're walking down and I make this YouTube short that was like, all right, you know, are you ready? Here we go. We're going to sweep 5 rounds in ID4. And that's the plan. And we say that because we knew that the math coming in was that 14-4 would be a guaranteed for the cut and 13-5 would be bubbling for the cut. So your goal is 14-4 at the start of the day, at least. And if you have a really good SOS, maybe you can go to 13-5. But yeah, we were like, okay, let's sweep 5 rounds ID4. We walk in there, you get paired round one, and there was some confusion about who you were paired against, because Cobra was had a lot of issues with so many people trying to load the site. So only certain people had it, and I found this person who had their phone out, and I was like, let's see where I'm at, and he like scrolls through and was like, oh yeah, you're on table 126 against Bridgman. And I remember looking at that, and Man in the Moon, aka Abraham, was standing across from me, and they're like, and we just like eyes wide, no way. Because in my mind, like, we're like, you know, we're like the like two like giants in the room in terms of people who are going to make the cut. Like if you were in my mind, like if you were to like, here's the people who are in the room, let's place bets on who's going to make the cut. Like I would put the most money on Bridgman before myself. And then I'd probably put the next on myself. by the way, he's made the top 16 World's Cup five years in a row.
That's sick. That's
sick. And yeah, I was like, I remember I screamed, like standing there, and I was like, there's no way, like this is how the tournament's going to start. And I remember I had to tell him the news because he hadn't found somebody who had the pairings yet. So I had to tell him the news, and we were both like very depressed sitting down at that table looking at each other. And at the time, like we were like, what are the odds of this? It's like a 1 in 259. You're the only person in this room that I would ID with round one, that I would even consider that. In hindsight, that's not true. I also ID'd with Koga in round three, who I mentioned already, but I also ID'd with Koga in round three. But for him, I was definitely the only person in the room that he would consider IDing with round one. So yeah, we were like, okay, well, let's ID. Like we both didn't want to risk getting swept by each other. We both were confident that if we just took a 1-1, that we can figure it out against other players and we can sweep our way up. And we didn't want to deal such a big blow of a potential getting swept round one to the other player. So yeah, we ID'd round one. It's quite the risk. Instead of, what is that? Instead of winning 5 rounds and IDing four, like you're basically IDing now and you're saying I have 8 rounds left and I need to sweep 5 of them. It's quite the risk, but you know, it worked out. I mean, I remember at the end of round five, so 4 rounds later, after that round one ID, like Bridgman and I were sitting 7th and 8th in the leaderboard, like right next to each other. So that was good to see.
Yeah, and important question: did you play it out for fun?
No. I told him, I was like, we should play this out and see what would have happened later. But we were definitely not going to play like at that time.
So Saka, you were mentioning Bridgman, who I know does a lot of Netrunner content. We've always talked a little bit about your Netrunner content. You both do really wonderful analysis, I think, and not just thinking of YouTube, but we've seen a lot of wonderful tournament performances by people who do really good Netrunner content. I guess this is sort of a two-pronged question that I wanted to ask. One, would you mind just talking about what you do in terms of like your videos, your streams, for people who aren't familiar? And two, how does that impact, you know, your competitive ability and how you approach tournaments?
Yeah, so I put out Netrunner content on YouTube and on Twitch at Sokka234. I do it on both platforms. Some people prefer one over the other. If you don't have a preference, I prefer YouTube. just because I think as a viewer on YouTube, it's very nice to be able to scroll back while the stream is live, and Twitch doesn't let you do that. So if you missed something that the person said, you can go back. And again, Twitch doesn't let you do that. So I make Netrunner content on both those platforms. It kind of started when, I just felt that I would be decent at doing something like that. And it was something that I thought would be fun to do. So that's kind of why I do it, at the very start. And I also felt that it would be something that could really help the community, help grow the community, and just help people who are interested in learning about competitive play. I focus most of my content on competitive play. There are things that I do on my channel that is, you know, geared towards having... Well, everything's geared towards having fun, but there are certain things that I might do. So, like, I'll play this deck or play this goofy idea that is quote unquote jank. But the thing is, like, whenever I do these things, I wouldn't ever like play a deck that actually doesn't work. Like, even if it's some crazy idea, like, I will still make that idea the best that it can be. And there's always like some merits to that, because it's some kind of idea that just people are not expecting or something or what have you. So that's kind of like the focus of my content is towards competitive play and towards focus of like player development and developing those like tournament or higher level, Netrunner skills. I think there's a lot of very good streamers who cover that beginner friendly intro content. Andre, Metropole Grid comes to mind, and Isengrin, comes to mind as well. And both of them make very, very good beginner and intro content, like intro to deck building, deck archetypes, or just like, I know that on the Metropole Grid, Andre will explain every card that kind of comes up and like, here's this card that I just mentioned. Here's the text of that card. And that stuff is really, really good. And I felt that I was where I kind of see my content is like the next step of a person's like Netrunner development is they learn the cards. They learn like the basics to deck building and deck archetypes. And now it's a little bit more about like competitive play and like, how do I manage my economy as a reg anarch deck playing against asset spam, something like that. That's kind of like where I feel like my content fits in. Which does mean that a lot of the times, I kind of begin with the assumption that people know what cards do. So I don't know if I, I wouldn't basically go through what the card text of a card is or talk about those like more beginner things. But of course, like if somebody asks, like I definitely would. That's like, I kind of see myself fitting in and in that area. To get to that second question about what that does for the purposes of my own play, It definitely helps to the extent that I am explaining things out loud, and sometimes I can just because by saying something out loud, you can catch yourself sometimes, and you say something out loud and you're like, oh wait, that doesn't actually make that much sense. That doesn't happen too often. Sometimes though, I might like play a tournament, and then at the end there might be a YouTube comment that was like, at this timestamp here, wouldn't this play have been better? And then I kind of like engage in those discussions, and sometimes I might explain like, no, that wouldn't have been better, and here's why. Or they might be like, yeah, you're totally right, I didn't think about that, or there was a lapse in my attention there. So that certainly helps. I will say that Bridgman doesn't stream when he plays in online tournaments, or at least in like high competitive online tournaments that he's looking to do well in, because he feels that it distracts him. And I would agree, like it definitely does distract you. I don't look at chat during my games, but you do like, there is an awareness that you are on stream. And also I talk through all my lines to stream, which I wouldn't otherwise do if I wasn't streaming. So there definitely is a certain degree of attention and difference in the way that I'm behaving just because I'm streaming, which definitely does to some extent detract from your ability to perform in the tournament, I feel. But I value developing community content and player improvement very, very much in the community. And I've had a lot of people tell me that my content is very helpful, and that's why I do it.
You mentioned that sort of talking through your decisions improves your gameplay, and sort of having to explain why you do things. Certainly that's something that, like, when I very first started playing Netrunner, I streamed my tournaments for exactly that reason, so I had to explain them. The other thing I did when I very first started playing Netrunner is talking to people on Discord and talking through games. In fact, my first conversation with you was in IPT, I think. We played a game where we won, I think, 6 out of 7 Psy games against Analyze. Yes. Chris. Yeah. would you like to either one, teach people the secret of winning 6 out of 7 Psy games against a good player, or two, play a Psy game? Take your pick. This is not a Psy game.
Can you repeat the...
Sorry, sure. Answer? Yeah.
That is so challenging you to a Psy game unless you explain your Psy game secrets.
Ah, yes. Okay. Yes, so... First of all, I'll start by saying that my transition, or I guess like my start of streaming, I didn't feel was that big of a change to me just playing Netrunner in general, because I felt that when I play Netrunner, a lot of that, the things that I say out loud when I stream, I end up actually like saying in my head if I'm not streaming anyways. Maybe not to a certain extent. Like I will make some thoughts in my head in terms of what it is that I'm thinking and the logic behind it. But then when I stream, like I actually voice it, and you actually make it into complete sentences and sometimes expand on a thought a little bit more than I otherwise would in my head. So in that way, like it was kind of like easy for me to kind of like jump into. We played a game against Analyze Chris. We were playing my Egg Infusion deck from 2020 Worlds, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And
we
played like a bunch of Future Perfect Psy games. I guess short guide to Psy games. So the first thing you need to think about is, does the money actually matter? Sometimes you're in this situation where it's the last turn of the game, it's the very last click, time has been called, and both players have 2 credits. So in that situation, money doesn't matter, and you're playing a true Psy game where you can bid 0, 1, or 2, and neither of the decisions has a consequence in terms of your money for future turns. That's usually not the case. There usually is like a money consideration. So if there is a money consideration, then like that, you just have to acknowledge that and kind of like think about what impact that might have in later in the game. If the credits are tight on any one side, then they probably don't want to spend two, and they probably really want to spend zero. And then you just have to like analyze like how important this side game is. So if you're playing a side game for the future perfect, and 3 points is a big deal, and you found a 1 in 5 out of HQ, and HQ is very expensive to get into, then it kind of moves closer on that spectrum of what I would call a true side game, where money matters less, because the money consideration is being outweighed by the fact that the outcome of this side game is just a very big deal. And then from there, there isn't really any rule. You just gotta read what your opponent is thinking. And if there has been a past side game, then that's very useful to think about. So if you've played a side game already this game, especially if it was recent, what did I spend? What did they spend? You kind of just look at your opponent and be like, do I think they're going to spend the same thing? Or do I think they're not going to spend the same thing? Because some people are just good, like they may just like spend the same thing. is there a tell? No, I don't think so. Case by case read, honestly. The one thing though is if you run R&D or run a remote for some reason, and there's a side game in a remote. How many cards even are legal right now that have a side game? Like Adrian Saïs is a side game, but that doesn't really, that has like two different outcomes, where one outcome is you access the other cards and one outcome is you access the Saïs and you probably trash it. And it's not really the same thing as like a Caprice or a Future Perfect, where one outcome, you do the thing and in the other outcome, nothing happens. And that's not what Adrian Saïs is. So in a Future Perfect side game, if you access the top card of R&D and it's Future Perfect and there's no ice on R&D and it's click one, then classically what happens is you're trying to like vamping the corp, right? So you just like spend zero, the corp spends one, and then you run back, and then you spend zero and the corp spends one, and then you run back, and that's kind of the game you play. And if you look at your opponent, you're like, they know that this is the game, then on the very first side game, you spend one. But you gotta do it quickly, right? Like the tempo of your actions matters a lot. So you're like, and you could do this on click two as well. So if you run R&D on click one and you see Future Perfect and you're like, all right, yeah, let's play a side game. And then you like move your closed fist. You take your $2, go under the table, and then you move your closed fist up right away. And then they'll do the same, and then you bid zero, they bid one, and then you go, and again, very quickly, you go click two, run R&D, you do the same action, same tempo, very quickly, and it looks the exact same, then the message you've just communicated is, I'm just going to vamp you for my four clicks by running R&D and bidding zero every time. So they're going to be like, oh, well, okay, I guess that's the game we're playing. They're going to bid one. But then you're like, surprise, I actually also bid one, and that'll take the agenda from here. So there's that. And now that I've said that out loud, like I will need to, the next time I access a Future Perfect off the top of R&D, I will need to consider if they listened to Null Signal Station and consider if they heard me say this, and we will need to play the next level of do I know that you know that I know.
The next time I play a side game after this interview, whenever it is, I'm going to bid zero.
Heard it here first.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Future Perfect, there was an announcement at Worlds about Dawn, kind of functional reprints of Fantasy Flight Games cards. Is there a card that you'd like to see come back that you've enjoyed previously that currently isn't in Standard?
Ooh, that I've enjoyed previously.
Oh, that's a fun question.
Just to kind of clarify what is going on. So I believe the announcement was that all of the FFG cards are going to get rotated. You mentioned the word reprint. Are there like certain cards that are going to get reprinted?
I don't think so. I think my understanding is that there's going to be Dawn, which is the code name. I don't think that's the name of the product, but it's going to be replacing System Update more or less. And I think it stands to reason that we're going to get some cards inspired by some of the cards that are leaving or some other classic cards from the game. But I actually don't know if that's...
It's not. I don't think direct reprints. No.
Yeah.
Certainly filling patches.
But I would love to. Would love to hear about Asaka. What are your beloved cards from the past, if any come to mind?
My beloved cards from the past. My beloved deck of the past is Prepaid Kate.
Ooh, yeah.
That's like a combination of a lot of cards, though, and Prepaid Voice Pad is still legal. I think if my answer is Kate as an ID, that's probably a lot of people will probably call that a very boring answer because it's just an econ ID, and we want to move away from econ IDs.
I will say if you're fond of Kate, I was looking at your IDs that you won worlds with, and there's still one Ashes ID that you haven't won worlds with. So, if you want to take to three-peat, I wouldn't mind. You can bring some nice prepaid As to worlds next year. It'd be great.
You know what? There's an As deck that we were looking at semi-seriously for a while leading up to prep for worlds. And Sebastian K loves his As, and he almost played it. It's not bad. I will admit I didn't put as much time into the deck as I probably could have, or maybe should have. Like, I think the deck is very strong, and I was just like, it was just safer to stick with the Reg Anarch and the Reg Sable than to fiddle with this. So I didn't, but yeah, there's a world. To elaborate more on that deck, the idea was just like, we're just going to install a lot of stuff for free because As can install DZMZ Optimizer for one credit. In addition to kind of the efficiency of the hardware and drawing a card when you install hardware with Masterwork. So you could kind of like use your DZMZ that you installed for a credit to install Shezvi, and then use Shezvi to install every other card when you play Biobands and run a central. So everything just kind of like funds itself. But it runs the issue of like, it's kind of like dependent on drawing your cards in the right order, which I think was just like a conceptual hurdle that I was not willing to take on in the prep to worlds. But yeah,
that makes sense. Speaking of cards that you love and maybe cards that you'd like to see coming up, you have two opportunities to put some cards into the world with your 2-time world champion wins. Any teasers or thoughts about what you're going to do with those?
Okay, so... I think, was it you who, no, it was, I think it was Dan B who suggested that I make a space sword.
What?
I saw that.
A space sword. The Sokka in Avatar The Last Airbender has.
Of course!
I should definitely do that. So I would like to make a space sword. I haven't talked to anybody about this yet. It's funny because I was thinking about like what I can do with this card. Cause I just like, okay, I would like to make a space sword, but what are the abilities? And I was like, I don't really know. And I was thinking that it should probably have a trash ability that says you can trash it to prevent an installed connection from being trashed, because at the end of Avatar, Sokka throws his space sword to like save him and Toph. So that's like a very like a thematic ability that I can incorporate into the card. But obviously the card has to like do something other than just trash itself to prevent a connection from being trashed. And I haven't quite figured out what that is yet. A sword kind of feels like it should be, in my mind, it should be a program, and it should be a program. But it could likely fit well as like a sentry breaker. But I want the cards that I make to be playable, and having a sentry breaker that has a trash ability that prevents a connection from being trashed doesn't seem like a great card.
I wouldn't say no to a physical meat space sword. That sounds amazing too.
Yeah. But if it's a sentry breaker and it trashes itself to save a connection, like when would you ever put a sentry breaker in your deck and then trash it to save a connection? And then now you go to a sentry breaker. Like that seems a little ridiculous. So I haven't ironed out the details yet, but I would like to do something with that.
Yeah, now you have the extra pressure of now you're designing a 2-card set almost. You got an extra entry in here.
So I believe, and it's been a while, but I believe I actually have 4 cards because of 2021 APAC and Intercontinentals. So mm-hmm. when they made that change of we are going to do champ cards only for worlds, that it was after that, and it was in 2022 that they made that change. And I was like, my daily quest alt art was the first, like, was the kickoff for that, which was kind of like a retroactive prize, and I was told that I would still get the champ card, but if I don't, that's totally fine. But yeah, there's potentially 4 cards in the works.
This sounds like a full mini faction.
The design team has a lot on their plate.
I mean, there are a lot of cards, or there are a lot of characters in Avatar: The Last Airbender. I'd love to see a cabbage card. You know, that sounds great.
Cabbage card.
The boulder, you know, probably needs some representation.
A cabbage would be pretty funny.
Doesn't lead to anything.
So I guess through these Worlds episodes, we've been hearing a bit about people's experience at Worlds and what they were up to, not just playing Netrunner, but kind of around Barcelona as well. Did you get up to anything fun while you were over in Spain?
I did. Not as much as I would have liked to or hoped, but I did. I mean, first of all, I hung out with a lot of really great people, and when I'm doing that, like, I don't really care what we're doing. We're going into a restaurant, just hanging out outside the venue, or maybe just in between rounds. Like, there's a lot of amazing people, both in my testing team that I knew that I was going to hang out with, and also some new people that I maybe wasn't expecting or thinking that I would hang out with as much. And it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that experience of just like hanging out with people that are just so amazing. So I did go out to Sagrada Familia on Tuesday. Amazing building. It's a church in Barcelona, very famous. I didn't know anything about it really, but yeah, amazing. Hadn't seen anything like that before. I was exhausted. So that was like the only thing I saw. There was lots more that I could have seen. As I said, I would have loved to do an escape room. I think a lot of people did go and do that, but yeah, it was exhausting. I was running on so much adrenaline and energy from playing the game And when I was playing and interacting with people at the venue, at the tournament, playing my games, like Netrunner gives me energy. And when I finished at the very end, at the end of Sunday, and it was all over, like that source of energy was gone. And I just was exhausted, completely exhausted. Like for the next couple days, like I just really wanted to sleep, but I also really wanted to hang out with friends. So that was a balance that was very hard to figure out. And luckily, like the people I was with was very supportive. And I think at the end of Tuesday, I was like, okay, like I actually need to go back. And cause I am just not feeling well. I really need to sleep. Yeah. And basically from like the end of Tuesday until Sunday, I slept for 14 hours a day every day for those, like, what is that? 6 days, five, 6 days. Yeah. Yeah, that was my post Worlds week.
Now, when we let some people know that we were having you on, there was one question that we were specifically asked to ask you. And that is, Sokka, are you team dog or are you team cat?
I believe I've been asked this before on a previous podcast, and I gave the answer... I gave like a kind of like an in-between answer. So I guess a little bit of background. I'm allergic to cats. However, I still absolutely love cats, and I interact with them despite that. And I think like over the years, I kind of learned that as long as I don't touch my face and touch my eyes, then it's fine. And I can kind of be in the presence of a cat. But I think last year or in years past, I've used the fact that I'm allergic to cats to say that I prefer dogs. And that was like the answer that I was going to give. And then I believe I was like thinking about this and I was like, you know what? No, I'm just nice. Team dog. Okay. Yeah, we're just going to give a straight answer to that one.
Wow.
Yeah, well, we're team dog, and I've now made a couple people disappointed and unhappy about that, but that's
okay. I mean, that's really kind of you. I know the people who are most passionate about team dog and team cat, if more than anything, you know, they have their own team that they're rooting for, but more than anything, they just want a straight answer. They don't want to hear about other animals you like. They don't want to hear about, oh, but both animals are very nice. They just want... They're very rude, actually. They just want you to say a thing and move on. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for doing them kindly. Team Dog, 2022 and 2023 winner of Netrunner Worlds. Congratulations, Team Dog.
I suppose to wrap things up, have you got any lasting memories of 2023 Barcelona? What are you going to take away other than the fact that you won the World Championships of Netrunner 2023?
What am I going to take away? Well, I mean, I feel like I take this away every time that I go to a large Netrunner tournament. Worlds last, I mean, I guess that's only two that I've gone to in person, like Worlds last year and Worlds this year. And the North American Continentals this year as well was quite a good turnout. The community is amazing. Like it's just such an amazing time, just like hanging out with people who enjoy the game. And I personally, like, I find it amazing that I'm able to make content and have people. Like help people in developing their Netrunner, and at these big events, like I'm able to meet people who like come up to me and be like, hey, like I really enjoy your content. It's really helpful. Like that to me, like means a lot. And it's, yeah, just like meeting all the amazing people and all the people at NSG and the volunteers were just amazing. That's the takeaway. And I'm really thankful for all the close friends I've made along the way. It truly is a really, really special community.
Well, thank you so much for being on with us. I really enjoyed talking to you and hearing some of your really great insights about the game, the tournament, the Netrunner meta, and what pet you like the most between two very narrow options. Thank you for being on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome to the Rules Corner. This is Sanjay. I am joined by Cephalopod Wizard. Cephalopod Wizard, what have you brought for us today?
Today, I've brought the definitive follow-up to the definitive episode about Magnet. Because last time, some notorious troublemaker of Metropole Grid fame said, how come you didn't talk about Saucy in the definitive Magnet episode?
It's pretty understandable. Magnet blanks everything, so it's hard to cover everything in the efficient time that you're doing it. Tell me about Saucy.
So when we think of Saucy versus Magnet or Hush versus Magnet, they sound similar, but there's actually different rules talking about what each one is controlled by. Hush versus Magnet, we have this loop of they both want to make each other lose all abilities, so we have to figure out some kind of tiebreaker. Saucy versus Magnet actually relates to static abilities and when those leave the game state. And when we're talking about Saucy versus Magnet, this also involves some other card degressing Magnet. But first, let's just remind ourselves of the rules text of those cards. Saucy is a criminal Trojan program installed only on a piece of ice. Whenever host ice is rezzed or derezzed, gain 3 credits. Magnet says, when you rez this ice, it steals another program and puts it on Magnet. We're not going to worry about that today. But it also says, each hosted program loses all abilities. So we can see this little conflict or ambiguity of Saucy's on a Magnet, but Magnet wasn't active when I chose to res it. Should Saucy give me credits or not?
Right, because usually unactive cards are it doesn't matter that if Magnet is unactive, the fact that it blanks the cards it's hosting doesn't matter. But in this case, it feels like Saucy is doing a thing as Magnet is becoming active. So yeah, how does that work?
So we need to talk about checkpoints, and we need to talk about the extra difficult here be dragons part of the comprehensive rules, which is static abilities and when those are entering or leaving the game state. And the short answer is that static abilities wait for nothing. They wait for no game processes. They are instantly effective or not active when we go to that instruction that says res magnet or derez magnet. So let's read carefully through the rules of checkpoints thoroughly. Step A of a checkpoint. Each conditional ability looks at changes to the game state since the beginning of the last checkpoint to see if its condition has been met. Any ability that has met its condition creates appropriate instances of itself and marks them pending. And then steps B through J don't matter. They're just cleanup. We don't care. And after a checkpoint is completed, a reaction window opens and we resolve these abilities that were marked pending.
And so in this case, when we're talking about conditional abilities, we're talking about Saucy's conditional abilities.
Yes, the conditional ability that says when host ice is rezzed or derezzed, gain 3 credits.
Right, because Magnet's abilities are not conditional. They're static abilities.
Yes, Magnus' static ability. That's what enters or leaves the game at the speed of light.
Beautiful.
So when we let's look at what happens. I have Saucy sitting on an unresed magnet, and the corp reses magnet. So we res magnet. We wait for nothing. No game processes. Magnet is active. Saucy has lost all abilities. So we move to the following checkpoint. Step A, we say, are there any active abilities? No, nothing happens. You don't get money when we res magnet. And the reverse is, intuitively, we can say, oh, well, when you reverse it, you do get money. And that does turn out to be true, but the reasoning requires some very literal reading of checkpoints. Because when we normally say a card has to be active of the during the relevant event to see that event. But with static abilities is where that breaks down. And what's actually happened is we go back to that wording and we say it looks at changes to the game state since the beginning of the last checkpoint. So if we reverse this and we go to, I have a Saucy on a resed magnet and I derez it somehow. Now, Magnet's static ability has left the game state without waiting for anything. We go to the checkpoint and we say, are there any active abilities? Why, yes, Saucy is active now. Why, yes, Magnet derezzing happened since the last checkpoint. And it doesn't matter that Saucy wasn't active when that line of text was resolved. It matters that Saucy is active now that we're working through the checkpoint. And then we proceed to resolve the abilities and you gain money.
I think that's interesting insofar as I think I love how you said it, that, you know, if you don't think too hard about it, it makes total sense. It's very intuitive. If you do think about it, it does make sense and it's logical, but it warps my brain a little bit that Saucy is not active when Magnet derezzes, but because when the checkpoint happens, it is active. Because that static ability happens right away, now Saucy does get to work. Did I get that right?
Yes, you got that right.
Wonderful.
So that advice of normally the card has to be active when the event happens, this is true for most of the game. Please continue to say that for pretty much everything else. But if we have a static ability that says something else loses all abilities, then come refer to this episode.
I'm looking ahead in the notes, and you put an example in here that I read, and I do not understand it. Could you talk about this one, please?
Yes. So we have a very popular card, DJ Fenris. When you install it, you host a Gmod identity from another faction on DJ Fenris. DJ Fenris gets that text. And in this example, we decide to host Lou on DJ Fenris. Lou reads, the first time you trash a card you are accessing, gain one credit and draw one card. A couple years ago, the example people were asking about was, what happens if you res Malia, targeting DJ Fenris? Malia reads, when you res this asset, choose one installed non-virtual resource. The chosen resource loses its printed abilities. And then you having this blank DJ hosting Lou, run and trash Malia. Does DJ Fenris hosting Lou become active in time to see that you trashed Malia and pay you for trashing Malia?
And so it would, because the checkpoint happens after you trash it. And the moment you trash it, Lou or DJ Fenris has active text. Checkpoint happens. And so it would conditional abilities of Lou, or sorry, DJ Fenris would become pending. Yeah.
Yeah, that is correct. This is almost exactly the same kind of sequence of events. 2 years ago, it was a little harder to work this out, but this time we looked back and said, oh, that was the solution.
That is lovely. Thank you. I think I got a better idea about how conditional abilities work relative to checkpoints with this. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, I think that's just about it from us for today's show. We packed quite a lot in there, didn't we, Seth?
Yes. Are we still recording?
What was your highlight? Oh, yeah, we're tightly packed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we've got separate tracks, so the editing team can decide what of this they want to cut out, keep in. They can keep in the bits where we talk over each other. It's fantastic, honestly. Big shout out to Ben and to Lox for the hard work they do on the editing. Absolutely genuine thanks there. But that is all we've got time for this week in a bumper episode. Thank you once again, my very special guest host, Cephalopod Wizard.
Thank you, Ed, for running the whole show.
Not at all. And if you've listened to this episode and thought, do you know what? I'd like to hear my name shouted out. I'd like to give feedback to the podcast. Be sure to do that. Our email address is podcast@nullsignal.games, or you can just reach out to me directly. I'm pretty much everywhere all the time. A big special thanks to Stevie Mack for the music on this episode. That's it from us. Thank you so much for joining, and see you next time. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.